We now join the BBC World Service in progress here on CFRU. CFRU.
And just as we were going through security, it said all flights are cancelled.
Breaking a taboo and talking about the dying.
Whatever is ordained for us is what will happen. So it's in our interest to be prepared and to be ready.
And will the clouds part tonight for Europe to see the total eclipse of the moon? That's all coming on Europe Today after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. The European Security Organisation, the OSCE, has expressed concern about Sunday's presidential election in Belarus, calling it seriously flawed. OSCE observers criticised both the counting of the votes and the violent backlash against opposition candidates. The most prominent opposition candidate, Vladimir Nekhleyev, was badly beaten, then reportedly abducted from his hospital bed. The wife of another candidate, Alexei Mikhailovich, told a BBC reporter what had happened to her husband.
They broke down the door and took him away. I don't know where. They said that they were from the KGB. But the KGB itself doesn't give any comments.
So you don't know where your husband is?
I don't know where my husband is.
The European Union and the United States also voiced criticism, with the Europeans saying that detained opposition figures should be freed immediately. But President Alexander Lukashenko, who was declared to have won a fourth term by a huge margin, accused his opponents of criminal behaviour.
What they tried to stage in Minsk yesterday was not democracy. It was banditry. The vandals and hooligans lost their humanity. They simply turned into beasts. You saw how our security forces behaved. They stood firm and acted exclusively within the bounds of the law. They defended the country and people from barbarism and ruin.
For its part, Russia said the election was an internal matter for Belarus. In Ukraine, the opposition leader Yulia Tymoshenko has been charged with abuse of power. Ms. Tymoshenko is a former prime minister. Prosecutors are investigating her over allegations that her government misused state funds raised by selling carbon emission rights. Pope Benedict has said the Roman Catholic Church should reflect on what's gone wrong with Christianity as a whole that allowed for the sexual abuse of children by priests. He said revelations of paedophile abuse had reached an unimaginable dimension this year. He added that the Church must give better training for priests. The Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales has ruled that the internet messaging service Twitter can, in principle, be used inside courtrooms to report legal proceedings. Here's Mark Gregory.
The issue is whether journalists are allowed to inform the outside world what's happening as it happens during a court case. There have been fears this could affect the eventual outcome. But now the most senior judge in England and Wales has ruled that the use of unobtrusive handheld equipment is generally unlikely to interfere with the administration of justice. However, he's insisted on safeguards. Permission from the judge hearing the case must be obtained first, and it may be refused.
World News from the BBC. The
American. Hello. Hello. You're tuned into Terra Informa, your weekly source for environmental news from across Canada and around the globe. My name is Anna McLeod, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This week, we have Miles talking with NDP MP Linda Duncan, discussing her experiences at a climate conference in Cancun. In our second segment, we will be airing part two of Dr. David Schindler's talk on measuring the effects of oil sands development on the Athabasca River. But first, here's Sana with the news. On December 10th, CBC News reported the study of wildfires and climate change. According to Mary Tursky, increasing temperature causes more wildfires, greenhouse gas emissions are increasing from the wildfire, and this phenomenon occurs not only in Alaska but in Canada. In 2004, there was 52 million tons of carbon dioxide released from the Alaskan wildfires only in 3 to 4 months. Mary Tursky, an ecology professor at the University of Guelph, she said that's equivalent to the amount of carbon released by all domestic airline flights in the United States for the entire year. Unfortunately, similar patterns occur in Canada, and since Canada has warmer climate than in Alaska, the possibility of fires is higher. A warmer climate causes ecosystem to dry, making the ecosystem weak in wildfires. As a global issue, climate changes from the wildfire is not the end of the problems. It can damage people's lives living in the north. Only a small degree of increasing temperature in decades causes to decrease the amount of snow cover, and it affects to resource developments like diamond and oil, and it also affects to people's recreational activities. Leah Bendel, a biologist in Simon Fraser University, insists that Health Canada has to enhance the guideline of proper amount of consumption of shellfish. She says the amount of cadmium in oysters, scallops, and mussels harvested in Coast BC is 2 to 10 times higher than in any other city in the world. Bendel says consumers need to know exactly how much shellfish they can safely eat to ensure that long-term exposure to cadmium doesn't jeopardize their health. CFIA, Canada Food Inspection Agency, reported that exposure to cadmium for a long time can occur to kidney damage, and Health Canada found that cadmium levels in oysters in BC were higher than other seafood. They recommend eating 460 grams or 12 oysters in a month is enough for adults, and 1.5 is enough for children. However, opposite to Leah Bendel-Singh, Guy Dean, vice president of Albion Fisheries in Vancouver, insists that their seafood industry has been disturbed from the kind of guidelines. He said because of the people who want zero tolerance in cadmium into their marketplace, so they have been restricted in where they send their products. The guideline about consuming shellfish in Europe says one oyster in a week is enough, and 3 oysters in a week is enough, according to the United Nations and World Health Organization. According to the CBC News on December 10th, Saskatchewan's power company is waiting for decision and emissions regulations from the federal government for a clean coal project. They will rebuild the old integrated carbon capture and storage facility at the coal-fired Boundary Dam power plant near Estevan, Saskatchewan. Robert Watson, the president of Sask Power, said they need to get some clarification and certainty of what the federal government are going to do. To minimize the climate change, the federal conservative government has spent hundreds of millions of dollars for a clean coal project. Per capita, Saskatchewan is the largest emitter of greenhouse gas from burning coal to generate electricity in the country. The company says they would spend $1.2 billion to rebuild Boundary Dam 3 as an integrated carbon capture and storage unit, but they could spend $354 million if they refurbished the 40-year-old unit to use 3 years more. And they expect that it will be the latest developed carbon capture setting.
Thanks, Sana. I'm Anna McLeod, your host this week on Terra Informa. If you'd like to check out any of our previous episodes, or re-listen to this one, you can find them all on terrainforma.ca. The Cancun climate talks wrapped up with a late-night agreement after a week which left most skeptical about the possibilities for international cooperation at the UN level. In an effort to gain a deeper insight into the process and outcome of the Cancun negotiations, Terra Informa correspondent Miles Curry interviewed both environmental activist Russell Charlton as well as NDP MP Linda Duncan as they left Cancun from two different international conferences on climate change. Now, here's Miles speaking with New Democrat environment critic and Member of Parliament for Edmonton Strathcona, Linda Duncan, the morning after the conclusion of the Cancun conference.
We're doing this interview on Saturday morning. I mean, there was lots of late night conference, 11th hour stuff happening last night. What came out of those negotiations? What is sort of the state of the Cancun conference right now?
Well, I have to share with you that I think this is expressed resoundingly by practically every delegate who spoke late last night, that the reason why there was success in reaching a final agreement, even though it's not a legally binding, what people were really excited about and gave absolute kudos and applause, endless applause, to the Mexican official who was the president and led the discussion, was because this time around, unlike Copenhagen, she insisted the process remain open and transparent and inclusive. So, as she said, all the doors were always open and all the parties were part of it, unlike in Copenhagen, where in the end, you may recall, that it was just a select number of countries that were pulled together that cut a deal. So I think that if I take any strong message out of what came out of Cancun was that it was achieved because they followed the important principles of openness and transparency.
Interesting. So how did that openness and transparency actually change what was the result of the negotiations? What's different?
Well, from what the delegates from a wide array of countries were saying is that it built the trust of it again. That at this process, I mean, going out of Copenhagen, people were very disillusioned, particularly from the lesser developed nations, because they felt that they'd been excluded and made irrelevant, and that it was only the big G8-type nations that counted. And so it was up to Mexico to try to turn that around here at Cancun, and to their credit, they absolutely achieved that. So I guess the message out of this that I'm going to be taking back as the New Democrat environment critic to the government of Canada is, okay, lessons learned here. Well, let's reverse course. Let's start making more open and transparent and inclusive the policy-making decisions of this government, and let's bring everybody to the table. There was still a lot of contention here. The youth delegation particularly upset that they were excluded from the process.
So speaking, I mean, maybe something that a little less positive, what was the conservative government's position coming into and at these negotiations? And how did that largely contribute to the end result of this conference? I mean, there was a lot
Well, they, of course, were digging in their heels. They didn't want to have the Kyoto mechanism continued over into 2012. And, of course, Canada is one of the countries that ratified Kyoto and is bound by targets, which a lot of us think were reasonable if we hadn't dragged our feet for almost 20 years. So they clearly did not want to be bound by those Kyoto targets and didn't necessarily want to carry forward the provisions of that agreement. But it's my understanding, and I haven't been able to read all the fine print yet, my understanding as the decision was, is that those mechanisms will be carried forward. So that was a real victory, I think, for the environment and for the lesser developed countries. Because under the agreement that we're still operating under right now, the major emitters were legally bound to reduce their emissions and to provide resources to the developing nations. So they were worried that if we didn't carry forward those mechanisms under that agreement, that they wouldn't have those commitments. So a lot of those commitments are included in this agreement. Even though this agreement isn't legally binding, the countries have committed to a number of actions, including the transfer of technology and the transfer of resources for the countries to adapt. Of course, as Tuvalu said at Copenhagen and is repeating here, all the money in the world is not going to help their country if they're underwater. Mm-hmm. So, the thing to watch for over the next year is the progress being made on the binding targets. Mm. President Morales of Bolivia was one of the few minority who spoke against signing off on this agreement. And the strongest argument I heard from him is because the targets of the Copenhagen are still going to mean that we're going to have climate catastrophe.
We're above 40 degrees.
So he felt that, that they wanted to still hang on to that bargaining chip to force the major emitters to reduce. But in the end, the vast majority of nations, almost all of them, were to consensus that they felt that they got a lot out of these negotiations and they wanted to sign off on the agreement, and they did.
Well, that, I mean, that's great.
Where is Canada?
Yeah.
I guess that's what we'll watch for.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing I'm really excited about. Last night in the wee hours of the morning, while we were listening to the endless speeches, I started going through the agreement. And I was excited to see that in the agreement Canada has signed, we have agreed that we will deliver on a clean energy strategy for Canada. And I and my colleagues have been mounting a campaign for that to happen ever since I was elected. So that's a strong message and a campaign I'm going to be taking back, and I'm hoping I can get a lot of your listeners on board to be putting the heat on Canada to, in fact, kickstart Canadian clean energy sustainability strategy, and through a process that is open, transparent, and inclusive.
Yeah. So where do you see the momentum maybe coming out of this going to into Durban? Is there going, like, last year it was really about there was Cochabamba right after Copenhagen Accord, where a lot of climate justice movement really gained traction and really started helping to support the developing countries. Where do you see the movement kind of moving out from this? Is there going to be sort of more cooperation? Is this multilateralism the new ethic that's going to sort of pervades the climate movement into the next year?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, the really neat thing is I met this wonderful woman from Reuters news service, and she actually maintains a separate website on climate alert. And I'll be posting that on my website so people can follow. And the neat thing about that is she spent the entire conference, unlike her colleagues, not going to the government wrangling and negotiation. She spent all the time at the side events. And, you know, people need to understand that these quote-unquote side events are actually an integral part of what's going forward. And at these series of international meetings that have occurred, there have been people that have come from state and provincial and municipal governments and First Nations and United Nations organizations, business and institutes and universities. And it's unbelievable the initiatives that have been forged through these meetings and are being kickstarted. And just an amazing array of innovative projects that are already happening on the ground. So essentially the second message that I've taken out of this meeting is people are not sitting and waiting for the government. Mm-hmm. They're already doing it. They're already trying to take action.
We've talked to you a lot about the Climate Accountability Act and Bill C-311, which was squashed in the Senate. So, you know, to the outrage of environmentalists and most Canadians, how can Canada's position have changed if that was law? Like, how would that change how we negotiate internationally?
To tell you the truth, I mean, that bill is very important, and it was important for two reasons. One, it would have committed Canada to the science-based targets. And from what we're hearing from the scientific community, those targets aren't even deep enough. So that's the important thing. That's the message we need to be getting out in saying that Canada has not committed enough. We need to do a bigger part. And the other part is accountability of the government. Now, interestingly, my bill, the Canadian Environmental Bill of Rights, is before committee now. And the last days of debate on that will be happening this Monday and Wednesday. And the reason why the timing is so perfect is the whole purpose and intent of my Canadian Environmental Bill of Rights is to give the public the legal right to participate in these kinds of negotiations. To me, the most important thing is that whatever policies we come forward on, whether they're energy, whether they're development, whether they're environment, they need to be grounded in what Canadians want, not just a small sector of fossil fuel companies.
Great. We'll definitely put a link up to that, and we'll keep our listeners posted on the development of those bills. Thank you very much, Linda. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, great to talk to you. Love your station.
Thank you, Miles. Tune in next week to hear Miles interview Russell Charlton about his experiences at the Alternative Conferences on Climate Justice and Respect for Mother Earth in Cancun. For those of you just tuning in, this is Terra Informa, your source for Canadian and global environmental news. We are heard across the country on stations such as CKLB in Tuktoyaktuk and CKDU from Halifax. Last week, we aired part one in a two-part series brought to us by Terra Informa correspondent Rebecca Rooney. Back on December 3rd, she recorded a talk titled Measuring the Effects of Oil Sands Development on the Athabasca River Ecosystem, delivered by Dr. David Schindler. Dr. David Schindler is the Killam Memorial Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. His recent research has concluded that the oil sands extraction and upgrading north of Fort McMurray does contribute to the contaminant load of the Athabasca River. This research clearly demonstrates that contamination from oil sands extraction and upgrading can be detected up to the range of 50 kilometers away. In part one, he focused on the increase in toxic metals and hydrocarbons in the snowpack, in tributaries, and in the main Athabasca River, and the reasons why the data collected by Alberta Environment and by the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program has historically failed to detect this contamination. In part two, he focuses on polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, often called PAHs, and associated deformities in fish. We pick up where Dr. Schindler left off, explaining how he was able to achieve more sensitive measurements of PAHs than Alberta Environment or RAMP, using a new sampling technique.
This new technique that we used are called PEMDs, for permeable membrane devices. They're contained in these little cylinders. They're just sections of aluminum pipe that have been sawed off about 4 inches long, and some screens put over them to protect the membrane, and the membrane is just wound on a little set of spindles within that. These were used in the Gulf of Alaska for about 16 or 17 years. They were well calibrated by NOAA and things. Under George Bush, they didn't have enough money to deploy them even, so we just borrowed them and used them in the Athabasca River. We just hung a piece of chain on these to hold them on the bottom of the river, a rope and a stake through the ice so that they could be retrieved. You can leave these in the river and they integrate the sample for up to a month. And you get a sort of an average of the organic contaminants in dissolved form during that period. The province uses what are called SPMDs, which are a section of a similar type of membrane but folded into an envelope and containing a little swatch of an oil, trialene. But Jeff Short recommended that we not use those because he said even the highest purity trialene that you could get had enough contaminants to raise limits of detection. So we don't know at this point what their limits of detection are. RAMP, who did their own sampling, has limits of detection of from 20 to 200 nanograms per liter, depending on which congener. And there are about 25 congeners of potential interest here. I'm going to show you two examples as to another part of the problem. Because people don't know a lot about the toxicity of combinations of these things, usually the index that's used is just total polycyclic aromatics, where they just sum and report that number. This would be RAMP's best limit of detection. Our limits of detection are all less than a nanogram per liter. So RAMP reports there's nothing there because they don't have limits of detection that can detect them. Probably another doubling of oil sands development, and they'll be able to do it. We got 682 nanograms per liter of total polycyclic aromatics. If you summed what they would have seen at best, it would have been 353. Well, if you read the literature, 400 nanograms per liter has been shown to be toxic in three or four different studies, fish embryos. So I'm going to switch for a few minutes to fish. We know from studies done at Queen's and some by the federal government that any fish eggs laid in that area have very high mortality, and that a high proportion of the larvae that do hatch are deformed. We see analogous deformities on some of the adult fish. These are all fish that were caught in the western end of Lake Athabasca in 2009-2010. And you can understand why people catching fish like this don't want to eat them. They probably are deformed because as eggs and embryos, they were lying in contact with this PAH high substrate. I've shown you concentrations in the water. My guess is that's an underestimate of what they're experiencing because there's high particulates in the sediments and there's probably a gradient out of the pore water of the dissolved as well. So among the various sorts of things, they mentioned the sorts of deformities that you see here. In larvae, spinal deformities are really common. This also in adults. Hematomas, this one was collected last winter in Fort Chip. Eye and mouth and head deformities of this sort. In this particular net, 7 out of 27 of the fish were deformed in one way or another. Tumors, this is a burbot. Northern pike with two tails, caught this year. So then you look at the literature and see what they're recording as larval deformities. And while I don't have the science to connect it, it seems logical to hypothesize that these horrible-looking fish that people are catching and won't eat are just some of the surviving larvae grown up. So I think some studies are needed to collect the dots there and see whether what's going on. So we really need a detailed study of fish health. I've been working in that area for about 35 years on one thing or another. In the 1970s and 1980s, people didn't report deformed fish. And even in the 90s, I thought, these guys must be making this up. I've seen lots of fish in that area. There's actually a 1981 report based on 1980 sampling of 17,000 lake whitefish that included examination for evidence fish disease that didn't turn up a single sick or deformed fish. It's only a gray literature report, and it got lost, the problem of gray literature reports in general. But it is there, and I know a number of native fishermen and two Western science fishermen with lots of experience on the lake who say that these deformities are fairly recent. The province disagrees. They say RAMP saw these right from the start. Well, RAMP started in 1997. So in between, we had things like this Suncor spill, which closed the fisheries on the lake for a couple of years. It was in Lake Athabasca by 8 days after the release. It was under ice, so there was nothing they could do about it. And I think if we think these tailings ponds are any safer than deep well drilling, we're dreaming. A few years ago in my 601 class, I had three students do a project investigating tailings ponds. And of course we had the one in Eastern Europe just 2 weeks ago that killed a couple of hundred people and so on. This tailings pond in Spain, engineers had just inspected this dike and certified it as being safe 2 weeks before this breach. The pond area was 160 hectares containing 15 million cubic meters. The spill covered 5,000 hectares and it cost $37 million to clean up. Well, here's Mildred Lake, one of the bigger tailings ponds in the oil sands. See what we'd be faced with if there were a breach that released any part of that, especially under winter ice. We have heard a lot in the past about the Sydney tar pond, so I've mapped them here. This little bar is a kilometer, so if you put them in the oil sands, you wouldn't even see them. We've procrastinated now for four decades about cleaning those things up because the cleanup cost is so high. Exactly the same compounds we're talking about in the oil sands. So I think it's time we made some changes to the way those things are regulated. We've got to have some reasonable conditions for approving oil sands. We have these sham environmental impact hearings where, as I said in my Nature article, it's like going to the opera. If you're an opera goer, you go not to find out what the plot is. You know that. You want to hear what various people are singing, but you know what's going to happen when the fat lady sings. At this point, they've approved about 90 of these things, these projects. There hasn't been a single denial. They've tweaked the rules on a few of them, but that's about it. We keep saying that we have the toughest regulations in the world. Just not the case. my view, you could never make these oil sands a totally sustainable development. I've been talking here only about probably number three or four on the list of problems. To me, the big ones are the lack of reclamation that's going on and the violations of First Nations subsistence space that have been guaranteed since